what's interesting to us in this particular kind of education is an unfoldment in a very specific way. For those who are at the Thursday lecture on Parmenides, you realize that because of the structure of the mind, whatever we know is equally balanced by what we do not know. That is to say, there is a universal law of symmetry operating, and that one cannot only expect to be informed about what is, but you have to at the same time be informed about what is not. And for a mature mind, you have to balance the understanding of what is and what is not together, so that reality occurs in pairs, not at all in static, single entities. That's not the nature of the real. It always occurs in pairs, so that there is a universal law of expression. One manifestation of it is the fact that numerical calculation on a real level is a binary instrument. One cannot just go with one, but one has to go with one and zero together. Or take modern nuclear physics. Not only does matter exist, but antimatter also exists. Just as electrons exist, positrons exist. And they are mirror images of each other. So it's important to recognize and understand that if you have an education that simply sells you a bill of goods, even if it's excellent and helps you to understand what is, if you haven't paid attention to what isn't, you become completely skewed and your mentality becomes flat and consequently seeks to balance itself out by making fantasy. And because you cannot see in terms of the real, you see what is, plus you fantasize to make up the what is not. So this is an endemic problem in nature and with man. And a good education always takes the pairedness of it together. But when it turns out to unfold the complete structure of the mind, not only do you have a pair, but the pairs occur as pairs also. In other words, pairedness is such a fundamental universal law that it extends even to pairs, so that the true fullness is a quaternary, a pair of pairs. Now, to the Chinese, to the ancient Chinese mind, it was important for them to understand that the pair of pairs that went together because they were together. And so there was a quintessential element, a fifth element, that was added to the pair of pairs. So that whenever you have a dynamic ecology in Chinese thought, it's always a five quality. But the pairedness of nature is so pervasive that the Chinese mind eventually came out with a pair of fives. And so it's an inscrutable way, unless you understand a certain basic natural beginning to the Chinese mind, which is a symbolic example for us of why we take nature as the beginning of the unfolding of our personality. If our personality is not natural first, it never will be full. It's like the timeless conviction that Dante had about symbolism. Dante is a major mind in world history, not just a great Italian poet. And the Divine Comedy can be read on four levels simultaneously, or read in each of four levels. But the essential quality that's there, the quintessential quality that's there, is that the mind, when it is dynamic, it has this wholeness that occurs in every part, so that you can't just say that there are four elements, for instance, earth, air, fire, and water. There's a quintessence that holds the four together as a unity. And that must be taken into consideration. Now, in the classic Western four elements, the four elements were usually put in a kind of a square, but superimposed on that square was a diamond, another quaternary, which were the relations between two of the angles of the square. So that if you had the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, you also had four relations: hot, cold, moist, dry. So that if you were to fully express everything that's there, the elements plus the relations, you would have an eightfold form with a quintessential wholeness bringing that eight together as a ninth. So that the classic hermetic phrase by the 3rd century AD, encapsulated in the classic title of one of the rarest of all manuscripts, that hermetic manuscript that was found among the Gnostic materials in the Nag Hammadi, the eighth reveals the ninth. And that the only way that the eighth reveals the ninth is that the eighth is silent. It's the silence of completion. Everything that can be said, not only about elements, but about relations, has been said, and one is silent. And in that silence, one hears the music of the ninth. The ninth, you can think of it as a sphere if you like, but actually it's the Gnostic pleroma. And one hears the singing of the divine on the ninth level because of one's silence on the eighth. The basic symbol to keep in mind for the Chinese, because the Chinese version of this is easier for us to follow than the Western. The Western Hermetic tradition has been underground so long that when you talk to someone directly in terms of the tradition, they suppose that you're speaking surrealistically, if not in a science fiction mode. So that this is to be expected because of the skew of the mind. The Chinese tradition preserves the nine quality in its relation to the eight, the pair of pairs raised to a pairedness, plus the wholeness, that's the ninth, preserves it in a pristine, natural way. So if you look at these, at the first page, this little handout for today, you can see, I put it on as succinctly as possible. Saturday class notes, 3:10:90. There's up at the left, the little tic-tac-toe emblem, and notice that X's are all around, and only the center contains a zero. The ancient Chinese village pattern had eight village families clustered around a central well. the nourishing source was centered. The process of renewal involved a going to the center. This movement ecology became a paradigm. All directions, four directions plus four intermediary. I better have some water or some tea. No, go ahead. Have some tea. All directions, four plus four intermediate equals eight. All the eight directions relate to a common center, which by itself would be unseen. In other words, the symbolic notion here is that the reason why this quintessential focus is visible at all to man is because man's activity, by following the ecological concourse, defines what otherwise would be invisible and unknown. So that the ancient religious understanding was that what you do is the very first level of the real for man. To put it in a simplistic religious language, man could not create God at all. But what man does makes a defining boundary which allows for man to observe a shape which he can recognize as expressing the unknown divine. So this ancient Chinese village pattern for the Chinese is the basic symbol to keep in mind. Now, the ecology of the five directions or five elements runs, and I put it down here, 1, 2, 3 in the center, 4 out to the right, and then 5, and then back up to 1. Or rather, because of the way that we're oriented in the west, put the 1 in the eastern part. So it moves 1 in the east, 2 in the south, 3 in the center, 4 in the west, 5 in the north, and back to 1 in the east. This is a natural movement cycle based on the above. The center, in terms of seasons, is deep summer. That is to say, in a lot of Chinese writings, there have been emendations on this. The various dynasties have had their philosophers. And because seasons were always under the thumb of the emperor, there have been times in dynastic Chinese history where certain emperors have wanted to scramble the real seasonal ecology so that there would be no competition. In other words, the Chinese are very, very keen about having no competition. But the natural place for this occurs still in the Huainan Zhu, in the fifth chapter of the Huainan Zhu, written about the 2nd century BC, and the prince of Prince Luan of Huainan was exceedingly refined individual, exceedingly trustworthy, and preserves there the actual place that deep summer, or we would say midsummer, is the place where the center occurs. So that you have four seasons, but you have a quintessential moment at the very center of summer, at the very center of the year. Now, in archaic Chinese tradition, for an emperor to take office, kingship was divine. He had to, at least once in his career, go and perform the Feng and Shan ceremonies. And Shan means mountain. And because of the nature of Chinese civilization, it was either centered in the western part of northern China, with Chang'an as its capital, or it was situated down in the river plains with Luoyang as its capital. The river Lo runs into the Yangtze there, and it was a capital city. Both of these places made it possible for sacred mountains to be used by the emperors to perform the Feng and Shan ceremonies, where the emperor would go to the top of the mountain and perform the Shan ceremony, whereby he would become empowered by heaven. He would be the only person on earth. The Chinese name for themselves is the middle country, the middle earth, the only place. Everything else is outlying. He would perform the ceremony by himself on top of the mountain, and then he would come to the base of the mountain and perform the ceremony a second time for the people. The first one, he gets empowered by heaven so that he has the power, the energeia. He goes down to the plain for the complementary ceremony where he demonstrates his power to the people, dynamis. So the Greek term for power, energeia or dynamis, has a very interesting interplay here, even in Chinese example. In this way, the center was established for each emperor. And that moment, that quintessential moment, then stood for the whole reign of the dynasty. In other words, it wasn't midsummer every year that this quintessential ceremony was done, but it was done in just a unique, rare event, usually. Now, if there were catastrophes and Chinese history is full of catastrophes, unbelievable catastrophes. The Anlushan Rebellion, China had a population of 50 million people, and 17 million people were killed within 2 years. Under those kinds of conditions, the emperor needed to reinstate his ability to rule by going through these ceremonies again. So that it happened occasionally, several times in a single dynasty. But the idea here, however infrequently it happened in historical, geographical terms, it was always understood to occur in terms of the realm, so that to a Taoist, the center has a place where it occurs in the ecology of the motion. And there's a little bit of a secret here. Because the center only occurs in a flow, the center is not a static center, but it's skewed just infinitesimal fraction to the motion of the dynamic. Now you have to understand, because this becomes extremely important in the 20th century in nuclear physics. The whole realization about the infinitesimal asymmetry of matter, because of the K0 meson decay of matter being a little bit slower than the K0 meson decay of antimatter, means eventually the whole difference that resulted in the physical universe. Had there been perfect symmetry, nothing would have occurred except gamma radiation. There would have been no matter at all. But it occurs because of an infinitesimal. How infinitesimal? One part in a billion. And in the Taoist thought, the same asymmetry is characteristic of the real. Everything is perfectly balanced except for the fact that it's slightly skewed to an ongoingness. Now later on, this gave rise to the love of the exotic and the unique. Chinese gardens are particularly places where the unique occurs in nature, so as to express this fact that it's impossible except that it happens in one unique event. So some weird shaped rock, like some half leached aggregate of granite and feldspar or something, would be placed in the garden. Now, you don't find this in the Japanese mind. The Japanese mind did not understand this aspect. And the Japanese mind makes a perfect symmetry, which results, incidentally, in the sterile quality of the Japanese imagination. The Japanese can imitate exactly, but they cannot initiate. That is to say, it's a fundamental quality of their mind, whereas the Chinese mind hates to imitate, but will agree to imitate because everyone who imitates makes a pattern against which the unique that can then occur. So the Chinese personality loves things to go on in the same way because this is a good background allowing for the unique to happen. Whereas the Japanese mind likes to weed out all of the glitches, including those which are natural and primordial. So there's a slight difference here. Chinese thought, Chinese Taoist thought, is easily factorable into 20th century nuclear physics. 20th century nuclear physics, though it came out of the Pythagorean matrix and tradition, is remarkably easy to understand, especially on the symbolic level, in terms of Chinese Taoism. And when Chinese Taoism was paired in a most ingenious way with Buddhism, that is to say, the analytical capacity of classic Buddhism synthesized with the incredible subtlety and asymmetricalness of Chinese Taoism, made the Taoist-Buddhist synthesis, which is called Chan Buddhism, it made it the most potent intellectual force in Asian history, easily. And the great genius of this was Hui Ning, who lived in the Tang Dynasty around 700 AD. And Hui Ning ends the whole lineage of Buddhist masters because he translates all of Buddhism into a Taoist mode. So Hui Ning is the sixth patriarch in China, after some 20-some patriarchs in India and six patriarchs in China, but there are no more patriarchs after Hui Ning. Why? Because the whole notion of a patriarchal lineage is broadcast to a cosmic fullness. So the seventh patriarch is anybody who can understand the real. Now, the Chinese understanding is expressed most poignantly in the I Ching. The I Ching is the workbook, the textbook, registering the way in which Chinese Taoist genius registered this kind of five-phase Tao ecology and its paradigm. So if you look on the Saturday class notes, there are trigrams here. There are two sets of three with an arrow ascending. The trigram movement is always rising. That is, when you read them, you start from the bottom and you read up. When you have a column of trigrams, you start from the bottom trigram and read up. This is the same for hexagrams, the same kind of rising order. So you read in a rising mode. Now, the center progression of these three trigrams, which is the progression of the yang, the unbroken line, the center turn here, the center trigram, the center of this progression of the yang is the symbol for kan, water. And then if you look below, you see the next set of three trigrams. They're the progression of the yin, of the broken line. And the center of the progression of the yin is li, or fire. So that water and fire occupy very conspicuous, poignant places in the progression of the yang and the yin. So that in a way, water comes to epitomize, as we would say in the West, water becomes to epitomize the movement of yang and fire the movement of yin. It's a very peculiar thing. But these two trigrams have the ability to exchange positions with each other. It's almost like the principle of valence in chemistry. The reason why two atoms can come together and make a compound molecule is because they can exchange energy levels, electron energy levels, with each other. So to get water, you have hydrogen, two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom coming together. And the two hydrogen atoms bind with the oxygen atom because the electron in the hydrogen atom is able to function on one of the shells or one of the energy levels of the oxygen. So that water is not technically a compound, but it is a new synthesis. In the same way, in Chinese thought, the movement of fire into the yang continuum and the movement of water into the yin continuum is exactly this kind of valence, this kind of binding. What is bound? It's not that fire and water are bound to each other, but that the progression of the yin is bound to the progression of the yang. Could somebody close that bedroom door? This is extremely important. It makes all the difference in the world whether one understands this or doesn't. Something that binds like this in an interchange of centers becomes a single unity. It becomes, I've used the example here, these two trigrams exchange so that we now have an interpenetrating single order, rather like a Möbius strip. So that the trigrams now function not as interesting parts of two developments, two progressions, but of one single order. Now the modern nuclear physics ascription for this kind of an order would be, they're called solitons. So that the Ba Gua functions as a soliton, as a symbolic philosophic soliton. That is to say, whenever it resonates the entire Möbius strip continuum and not just one part of it. So that it's rather naive. It's like a grade school child who doesn't really understand anything at all, and somebody says, this is this trigram working, and that's that trigram working. It's not that way at all. All eight trigrams function together all the time. It's only through our attention that we select out some aspect or other. I have to use a kind of a grade school example here. Think of a bubble, a soap bubble, and the light is glistening off just one little arc of the soap bubble. Well, the arc of reflection, of reflected light, is not the whole bubble. It's just what you're seeing right now. The same way, to a Taoist, the real is infinitely mysterious all the time, because the only aspect that you're seeing is the aspect that you're selecting out at this particular moment, and all the other aspects, though they are there and functioning and working, you're not selecting out. So that the Taoist analysis is not about nature in a limited, partial way, but about what is happening in you that your attention only is selecting out a partiality. So again, the Chinese Taoist would understand that if you're seeing a partiality in nature, it says a lot about you and doesn't say anything about the universe. So that nuclear physicists around 1927, Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg, began to talk about this aspect, and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle came out of these kinds of conversations, out of a direct influence of Chinese thought. Now one could ask and say, well, did Bohr or Heisenberg go to China? That's not it at all. That's very simplistic. That's not understanding at all. The whole structure of higher mathematical thought, of calculus and beyond, in the Western mind, was influenced by Taoism in the form of the I Ching from its inception. So that anybody who has ever used calculus and beyond has put into effect the I Ching and Taoist thought. Now, how is this so? Well, the Greeks never had calculus, oddly enough. It's like Frank Lloyd Wright once said, if the Greeks had had glass and steel, we wouldn't have to have any architecture schools. We'd just have little instruction places where we'd learn how to build. But they didn't have glass and steel or concrete. So one has to learn how to do things all over again because the old principles are not sufficient. There was a time when the Western mind synthesized for the first time higher mathematics, which is the language used in physics and astronomy, incidentally. So it's the language used in 20th century cosmology. The whole synthesizing idea of cosmology in our time is expressible exactly in equations in higher mathematics. And perhaps the most colloquial famous of all the expressions is the one Einstein's equation E equals mc squared. But the fact is that not only does E equals mc squared, but E equals minus mc squared just as well. You can write E equals minus mc squared, and it's exactly right. Also, now Einstein set that aside because he was busy enough with what he was doing, but there were a few individuals like Paul Dirac that just couldn't set it aside. It kept them awake at night, and finally, around 1930, it was understood for the first time that this means that the universe could theoretically build negative matter, negative worlds, negative stars, negative beings. That would be just as logical as the world of matter. Notice here that the paradigmas, the old Chinese Taoist paradigmas, holds very, very, very well in nuclear physics and in mathematical astronomy. And yet, symmetry has about it a very peculiar, asymmetrical, quintessential, unique secret. So that if you go, the classic on symmetry in Western physics literature is by Hermann Weyl, W-E-Y-L, published by Princeton about, oh, I don't know, 40 years ago or so. We've got a copy here someplace. It's out in paperback, too. But Weyl's symmetry carries the mind just so far. And the end result is that there's still something mysterious. What is mysterious? That anything happens at all. How is it that anything is? And the person who unlocked that kind of secret was the head of that inquiry was Richard Feynman. And his work which is summarized in his last great little book, QED, Quantum Electrodynamics, shows that, in fact, the ongoing movement of life gives a slight edge to occurrence over non-occurrence. So that while non-occurrence is extremely important, and one has to understand that what is not also occurs, what is occurs just a billionth of a fraction more. It's like saying that the divine has a stony face until the very last second of existence and then smiles. Gives no indication whatsoever for the entire career of the universe, and at the very last second, smiles. So that there is an odd kind of an eerie flavor to reality. It has an impending joy. So that when one goes into deep samadhi, the distinct feeling that's there, I think classic Abhidhamma metaphysics distinguishes 57 states of feeling that human beings are capable of discriminating, and only three of those are painful. All the rest of them are rather blissful. But the feeling is not so much bliss, but a kind of very subtle, elegant elation. That's a distinctive tone. It's like a background radiation that's there for sentient beings. So notice here, then, that the Tai Chi symbol, the yin-yang symbol, the black dot in the white indicates that this is the water, and the white dot in the black indicates that that is fire. So the reason why those two dots are there in the yin-yang symbol, the Tai Chi symbol, is that they symbolically are there to show this trigram operates in that continuum, and that trigram operates in this continuum, and that's why it is a unbroken unity. So the Tai Chi symbol, the Tai Yi Chi, is a soliton. In terms of nuclear physics, and operates that way. Now the completion, I've got this on this first page, there are two boxed expressions, and in between I've written, now the completion of all three, we're coming back to the two columns of movement. The movement of the, let's take the first one, is an unbroken line. Notice that in order for the unbroken line to be seen, it's surrounded by two broken lines. In the first place, the unbroken line is at the bottom. In the second place, it rises to the middle. In the third place, it rises to the top. Now, if you want to express the complete unbroken line, you would abstract its three positions, its three energy positions out, and you would then write it symbolically as three unbroken lines. That would be symbolically yang, pure. So if one wishes to write yang in terms of the I Ching, you cannot just write an unbroken line. You have to write three unbroken lines. That's the correct expression. So that in the I Ching, yang is never just an unbroken line. It's three unbroken lines. The same thing for yin. So that when you're working, you have to understand that the I Ching as a whole, the hexagrams as a whole, occur in two related forms. They occur first as a matrix and second as a cycle. And the only way to understand the matrix and or the cyclic wholeness of the hexagrams is to realize that each hexagram is always the interpenetrating play of yin and yang, three lines by three lines. That's the very first thing to understand. It's a very peculiar orientation. If you learn some other way about understanding the I Ching, it may seem very, very strange to you. Most of the commentaries that you find about people making money about writing books about the I Ching base themselves on Ming Dynasty Neo-Confucian palaver. And I love going to Wang Yang Ning too, but I don't. I go there with my eyes open. And the best way for us is to go back to the classic Taoism of Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu. In other words, go back to the 3rd century BC at the very earliest, because one, the material is available. We have a Tao Te Ching of that time period. We have preserved for us in the I Ching the expressive levels of that time period, and we have in the writings of the inner chapters of Chuang Tzu a perfect, elegant human being who was able to live in terms of that classic Taoist understanding. So we have enough information, and when you put the essays of the Huainan Zhu with it, we have more than enough to go on to orient ourselves to what is primordial in the Chinese understanding, and not what is later emended by polyglot Neo-Confucian scholars who were trying to please the Ming court, and then the Qing court after that. I guess I should tell you a humorous little story here to relieve your minds. In 1911, when the Qing dynasty was falling, they were taking the sign of the Qing dynasty workmen were off the Tiananmen Gate, the one that's been in the news just the last year. And so there was this big bonfire, and they were throwing all the trash on this bonfire, get rid of them. The Republic is here. The Manchus are out. And the workmen were about to throw the sign of the Qing dynasty on the fire when suddenly they stopped and they set it down and they started talking to each other, and they finally agreed and they said, well, look, these Qing guys were around for a long time, and who knows, they might be back. We better not burn their sign. Let's just stuff it up here in the top of the gate so that if they do come back, well, we can put the sign back up, all right? So they were trying to stuff the sign up, and it wouldn't go, and it wouldn't go. So they set the Qing dynasty sign down, and a couple of the guys went up there, and they reached in to try and find why they couldn't go in there, and they pulled out the sign of the previous dynasty. That's China. In other words, the Chinese conviction is that there's an ongoing flow that has its own principle. The word for principle, Li. Its principle is the basis, the foundation by which energy, qi, occurs. And without Li, there's no qi. So that if you're moving by Li, the qi is there, like automatic. So it's absurd to a real Taoist to try and go through exercises to generate qi so that you can understand Li. That's like painting the cart instead of going and getting a horse and thinking that the cart's going to work a lot better because it's freshly painted. You don't have a horse. In other words, the dynamic principle is Li and not qi. The qi is there by virtue of Li occurring. So that in the classic Taoist understanding, the only thing to concentrate on is the Tao. If you can attune yourself to the Tao, then everything else follows in order. To thine own self be true. And as day follows night, everything will occur. Right. So that the completion, let's come back here now, the completion of all three, the abstract...